Good afternoon to everybody. Of course, what's on all our minds is that this is the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Correct? I'm not going to say very much about the Russian Revolution, you'll be pleased to hear. But it is quite impressive when you think about what effect that revolution had and what effect the ideas that lay behind that revolution affected. The huge change, the whole 20th century dominated, at least in part, by the ideas that Marx and then Lenin engendered, which we won't go into the effect. We all know it was highly ambiguous, some good, quite a lot of bad. But it had a huge effect. Ideas, the ideas that were inherent in Marx's analysis of existence, of how things change, how things work, and especially his analysis of social conflict. He, of course, is a dialectical materialist. He considered that social conflict was derived from the material base, from the means of production and the economic system and so on. And that idea has been a dominant idea all the way through the 20th century and even still resonates. It affected even fascism and so on. So what I think we can reflect on in noticing that we're at this juncture, this 100th anniversary of this enormous event in human history, the power of ideas, the power of a view, in, as we would say in Buddhism. And so I want to explore this a bit in these next 3 days, and I want to explore it through a teaching of the Buddha's that is actually connected with explaining social conflict. As Marx explained social conflict in terms of the inherent contradictions within the capitalist system, the means of production of the modern industrial economy produced, according to him, conflicts, class conflicts, which burst out in social tensions, in revolutions and disharmony within countries, and in conflict between countries. And of course, there's a great deal of insight in what he has to say. In many ways, Marx is to be attended to still, even if we, as Buddhists at least, cannot agree with the fundamental philosophical perspective of dialectical materialism. But what we get with Buddhism is an analysis of the processes that produce social tension and conflict, disharmony, even violence, is quite different. It's not completely unrelated. I'm not going to try to make the relationship, but it is quite different. Of course, it's more connected with inner processes, the processes within the individual and the way those play themselves out. So I'm going to try to explore what the Buddha has to say in this very important sutta. Sutta, for those of you who don't know, means a discourse, which is a record, as near as we can get it, of what the Buddha said. They've been preserved in different traditions, in different languages. The one that we're most familiar with is in the Pali language, which is a relative of Sanskrit. And a relative of modern Indian languages, preserved in Sri Lanka. So we're going to look at this sutta and see what the Buddha has to say about what produces social disharmony, and in the course of doing that, try to understand more fully what theory is, what views are, what ideas are, and the way in which they shape behaviour and shape, indeed, in this context, social conflict and tension. As I say, not unconnected with economic conditions and so forth, of course, but more profoundly connected with inner processes, more profoundly because it means that we can take more direct personal responsibility. Marx famously said, there's no individuals, there's only society. It took the great thinker Margaret Thatcher to contradict that. That's a joke. In other words, the individual is a sort of merely a part of a social system that is formed by economic means of production, therefore class and so forth. But in Buddhism, the emphasis is on the individual and the individual's responsibility to society and the individual's capacity to change him or herself so that harmony is preserved, tension is avoided, and so that a genuinely free and just society can be produced. So we're going with the same objective. I think if you read Marx and the early Marxists, which I've done a little, not very much, it's very clear there's a really sincere desire to see a better society, a more just society. But so the ends are, in a certain sense, not dissimilar to our own. But the means are quite different, and the underlying analysis of reality is absolutely different. So this sutta, you need to see the scene cut to the opening shot. The Buddha is sitting, as he often would, in a clearing, in a park, trees all around. Park, not like Victoria Park, a place that was set aside on the edge of a town, a big town in this case, and which was set aside for wanderers, people who'd left the conventional civil society to explore new dimensions of experience, try to find solutions to the deep problems of existence, to human suffering, fundamentally. And the Buddha's sangha, his monks and nuns, were simply one group of these wanderers. So the place was set aside for any wanderer. Often there would be the convention that provisions would be offered to them. They'd have the possibility of begging for food and so forth. But they'd gather in these parks and they'd meditate together, the Buddha's disciples together. They'd meditate together. They'd listen to the Buddha teaching and they'd share their lives together. So the Buddha's sitting in the midst of his monks and nuns, probably lay people all around who'd come and visit him and spend the day there with him. And a wanderer who belonged to a different sect, if you like, to use that term, came by. And his name is Dandapani. Danda means stick. Pani means in the hand. So his name is Stick in the Hand. You've already, in the name, got some idea of what he was like. And he strides up to the Buddha, and in the language that's used, you can say that he's quite blunt, even rude. He just sort of comes to the Buddha without any even ordinary human courtesy and just says, "What do you teach? What do you promulgate?" And the Buddha answers in a rather indirect way, which was his wont. He says that I teach in such a way that there is no disharmony. There's no quarrelling. There's no argument. It's interesting, isn't it? It's the way he teaches that he's focusing on, that his teaching does not set up opposition. Presumably, Dandapani is looking for a punch-up, a debate. He's looking for the Buddha to say, this is what I teach. Dandapani will say, this is what I teach. They'll have a nice argument, and one or other of them will feel that they've won, probably both, and go away resentfully, and so on. But the Buddha just gives this very simple answer that I teach in such a way that there's no disharmony. And he says something a little bit more complex after that, which is rather opaque, not very immediately obvious what it actually means. Oh dear, I better read it to you. So that you're suitably confused and I can dazzle you with my solution to it all. So he says, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world. Holding to this teaching, in other words, you're not set in opposition to anybody. In the world with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, in this generation, in this mob here, with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, everybody, natural and supernatural, if you like. I teach in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that brahmin here. Brahmin means not the caste member, but the worthy one, who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. So I teach in such a way that perceptions, that needs investigation, no more underlie, well, that's an interesting phrase, that Brahmin, that worthy one, who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being, who's basically happy, at peace, not disturbed, because perceptions no longer underlie his mental processes. So Dandapani isn't exactly satisfied with this, and I really love to make a film of this. Somebody should do so. He shakes his head, wags his tongue, and raises his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered in three lines. 1, 2, 3. And wagging his tongue. I don't know what he means. I tried to mimic this, but perhaps it doesn't matter. But anyway, he's really not convinced, and he's trying to indicate contempt and disappointment. Well, not disappointment, but more contempt. And he just goes off banging his stick on the ground. So the Buddha sits for a while. He's quite content. He's said what he's got to say. And the people around him, the followers around him, start sort of looking at each other. What on earth did he mean? What was he trying to say? And So eventually somebody plucks up courage and asks the Buddha, and he says something that in a way is even more gnomic, that doesn't really make it any clearer what he means. And then he gets up and goes. Interesting to sort of try and see if you could guess at what was going on for the Buddha. Presumably he wasn't in the mood for a longer explanation. He'd had a hard day. So he goes off into his hut, and the monks and the nuns and the lay people sitting around trying to work out what the Buddha meant. And eventually they say, I know what, let's go and ask Mahakachayana, who is an elder who is noted for the lucidity of his explanation, for being able to say at length what the Buddha says in brief, as often the function that leading disciples have. The teacher says something, and then you get a large debate about what he really means, and then somebody really authoritative and knowledgeable explains what he really did mean, and then everybody disagrees with him. But that's another question. They send for Kachayana, and Kachayana says, okay, what's the problem? So they said, this is what the Buddha says. What does it mean? So Kachayana asks the obvious question, didn't you ask him? And they say, no. So he gives them a bit of a tongue-lashing and says, well, you know, you should have asked him while he was there. They said, yeah, you're right, we should have asked him while he was there. So, and then he relents and he explains. And what he says is of startling lucidity and of very great import. So this is quite interesting. What we're looking at is not the Buddha's teaching. It's an explanation, if you like, a commentary on the Buddha's teaching that clarifies what the Buddha meant. After it's all over, the Buddha reappears. So they tell the Buddha what Kacayana had said. And the Buddha says, yes, that's what I meant. It's as if I had said that. So we've got ultimate authority. This is what the Buddha was getting at. So, what did he say? Now here I'm going to have to resort to a flip chart. So he gave a nidana chain, what we call a nidana chain. Nidana we usually translate as link. Actually what it means is base, something from which something else comes, something on which something else stands. So if you have this, then that stands upon it. And then if you've got this, then that stands upon it. So it shows patterns of conditions that arise, one independence on the other. If you have this, then this happens. If you have this, then that happens. If you have this, then that happens. And it all results in a punch-up. It all ends with social disharmony. It ends with the taking up of the stick. Interesting, because he's Dandapani. It results in violence, in disharmony, in harsh words, in quarrels. So I'm going to unfold that that Nidana chain for you. And first of all, to just simply write it up and go over it in brief. And then I'm going to explain a little bit more carefully what it means, and probably over the next couple of days I'll need to go more deeply into certain parts of it, because I want particularly to see how ideas lead to problems. So it starts with immediate sensation, you could call it. In Pali it's pasa. In Sanskrit, it's sparsha, immediate contact. So those of you who are here for the meditation, I was trying to get you to experience the immediate sensation of the contact of your foot with the ground. So it's the sensation without any interpretation. You're not even thinking foot, you're just feeling. You're not even feeling ouch or nice. You're just, that's the raw sensation, primary sense data, you could say. The contact of the senses with the object in consciousness. It's said in Buddhist psychology to be the drawing together of the sense organ with the corresponding object of the eye, with a visual object, with the consciousness, a visual consciousness. So sensation is the drawing together of all of these to produce an image, if you like, an image, whether of whichever medium, whichever sense it's coming through. Sensation always gives rise to hedonic impulse. We don't really have an adequate word for what it gives rise to in English. We might say feeling, but feeling so elastic, it stretches from really the sensation itself right the way through to an emotion. But Buddhist psychology is very precise about this and really usefully precise. The word that's used in Sanskrit and Pali is worth writing up so that you know it, because anything I say to try to translate it into English doesn't really quite do it. It's vedana. It's very difficult for speakers of modern Indian languages, because vedana now means only pain. It took me a long time to realise this. There are a number of things like that that it took me a long time to realise. For instance, it took me a long time to realise that samsara in modern Indian languages means family. So, you know, samsara, nirvana, well, we won't go there. So vedana is the hedonic tone that sensation gives you. If you bang your hand on something, there's an immediate sensation, which is just a contact of the object with the organ. In this case, the body is the organ. And then there's a painful feeling. Or, you know, you stroke something or eat something pleasant, there's a pleasurable feeling. So that's the vedana. It's an immediate impulse, immediate sensory contact. Happens so instantly you don't notice it. You can, if you're very mindful, begin to notice the difference between the immediate sensation and the hedonic response to that. Hedonic, to do with pleasure and pain. Independence on that arises, again, we don't have an accurate translation for this word, so I'm going to tell you the Sanskrit word, which is samya. Again, a false friend in modern Indian languages. It doesn't mean quite the same, more or less, but not quite. Samnya. There's a tilde over the N. Samnya. It really means interpretation. It means the taking of the raw data of sense experience and the forming of it into an intelligible elements, if you see what I mean. So that, you know, I touch, that's the sensation, the sparsha is the word, contact. There's a bit of pain because I hit my hand a bit hard. And then there's a beginnings of an interpretation of that. Hand, whiteboard, you know, what do you call this? Flip chart, sharp edge, that sort of thing. So I begin to label my experience. And that's the primary function of samnya. We'll see it goes much further than that. Samnya is a bit interesting because it covers what in psychological or even philosophical terms is perception and conception. You see what I mean? So that one of the first things we do with our experience is just sort of break it up. But that sheep do. I make an intimate study of sheep because I live in Wales. Nothing much else you can do. But sheep are obviously trying to work out what they can eat and what they can't eat. Apparently they can recognise five faces. Mainly, of course, the farmer. Yes, pretty good lot, a good lot. So they recognise the farmer because he's the one who feeds them. So they go running up to him. They don't recognise me. They run away. I'm useless to them. So they are performing a sort of very rudimentary form of samnya. I imagine you could even say an amoeba does. It knows heat, cold, light. Sorry, I don't know much about amoeba. I've never met one. But they do have a sensory relationship with the world around them. They're able to presumably see what they can eat. What do amoeba eat? Anyway, they're able to see what is fuel for them, and they're able to avoid what is presumably dangerous to them. So even the most primitive of organisms, in our terms, has some degree of sensory samnya, of interpretation. Good, bad. Want it, don't want it. Capable of mating, not capable of mating. Enemy, friend. And so on. I've been reading this wonderful book, The Hidden Life of Trees. Anybody read that? A glorious book. And he basically sort of explaining the way in which trees are extremely sensitive to the environment in which they find themselves. He was a forester, according to the sort of standard commercial forestry philosophy. And he began to realize that the trees were a lot more complex and alive, a lot more sensitive than he'd thought. Extremely interesting, their ability to sense when there's, for instance, an attack of an insect that is threatening to them, and then to respond by sending bitter flavour to the leaves and that sort of thing. Of course, it's all very slow, but you know, this is what Lord of the Rings is, isn't it? Do you remember what are they called? The
Ents.
Ents, you know, they're very, very slow, but they are sensitive to the world around them and they're responding to it. So probably, well, no, not probably, all life has some kind of samnya. So even to say that, even to for the organism to detect that this particular aphid requires this particular set of chemicals, although we can explain that in chemical and biological terms, it is a sensory response. And it does involve discrimination. That's what samnya means. It means a primary basic discrimination that parcels the world up, this undifferentiated flow of experience, which is life, which comes at us undigested and without parts. The primary flow of experience is without any differentiation inherent within it. But according to the kind of organism we are, the kind of consciousness that we have, we take that undifferentiated flow and we break it up into bite-sized munches. Appropriable elements that we can manipulate. If we're a single-celled organism or a beech tree, it's a very very simple response. This is this kind of aphid. Well, of course, they don't think all this. This is our pathetic fallacy, our interpretation of it in terms of our experience. But it, in certain sense, knows, and I think you have to extend the word know to include that. Know is what samnya is, really. It knows what it is, and it knows what to do about it. And it goes right the way up to the higher animals, as it were. And in us, it takes another form, which is that of conceptualizing. The labeling is not merely an instinctive differentiation, compartmentalization, instinctive. It's a translation of the elements into concepts, generalizable concepts. Huh? We'll come back to this later, but for the time being, let's just leave it there. So samnya includes perception, the grasping of the world in terms of discrete elements, and of course their relationship with each other, general propositions, if you like, about them. And at a more complex level, their interpretation in terms of concepts, and then the arrangement of those concepts into theories and ideas and so on. At this stage, we're only concerned with the faculty of perception and conception, of interpreting the raw data of our experience. So in the human case, what ensues upon samnya is thinking, ratiocination. The word is vitarka. Tarka in modern Indian languages means logic, actually. Tarka shastra is the study of logic. So vitarka is the discriminative thinking. So you're taking the concepts that samnya has given you and you're arranging them into logical patterns. Sometimes not very logical, but they aspire to be logical. Do you see what I mean? So that you you begin to use the concepts that you've derived by the faculty of Samya to reflect upon your experience. Why you reflect upon it, we need to come back to later. But for the time being, the reflection takes place, let's say, just simply to handle your experience for what you perceive to be beneficial. So you think, you having interpreted, you use your interpretation to a higher order of interpretation. It can become extremely high order interpretation. It can become almost completely abstract. So, yes, we'll call it thinking. It probably do. What then happens, if we're not very careful, and if the impulsion to think is very strong, in other words, usually, if there's strong Vedana. Now I'm giving the game away. I was going to do this later, but I have to do it now. If there's strong Vedana, then your thought is directed to either removing the pain or to perpetuating the pleasure or making the pleasure endure. Of course, Vedana is not merely just immediate sensation of pleasure and pain. It can become extremely sophisticated. The pleasures of art, of looking at something really beautiful, or even the pain that goes with recognition of your own unskillfulness. So it can become much more refined and much more purified, if you like. But it still has an effect, and it drives you to a greater or lesser extent. So you're thinking to try to resolve the problem that your experience has dealt you. The problem of how to get rid of the pain, or the problem of how to get more pleasure. Quite simple and quite obvious and absolutely basic to us, and very important to be much more aware of this sequence. Again, I hope we'll be able to look at this more closely. It's a question of trying to notice the pattern, the way it unfolds. And we're going to see how it goes wrong. And so the solution to it going wrong is to try to go back and catch it before it goes wrong. But you get the basic sequence so far. It's pretty automatic, or it just built in. It's part of what the organism is built for. It has sensation. It receives information through the senses from the world, without questioning what the world is for the time being. We won't get too philosophical about that. It delivers you hedonic response. Initially, probably that, from an evolutionary point of view, that hedonic response is, no doubt, has evolutionary value. What is unpleasant is probably not good to eat. What is pleasant is probably a good direction to go in. Of course, it gets very deceptive, doesn't it? And then the samnya orders the information that's coming to you into packages. And at the level of a human being, it's ordered in terms of concepts, which of course are strongly related to words. See what they are in a while. Then you take those words and you start to, those concepts, and you start to relate them to each other. Ideally according to logical patterns, but often simply on the basis of what we'll come back to later, which is very powerful latent tendencies which take over and prevent you from thinking clearly. We'll see what they are in a while. So what then happens is it goes out of control. I think probably everybody here has done some meditation, and I think probably when you've meditated, I don't want to put thoughts into your brain, but it's certainly a very common experience. You sit to meditate, You try to watch your breath and your mind just spins. If something's happened during the day, somebody said something to you that was unpleasant, or somebody said something that was pleasant, that gives rise to certain possibilities, away your mind spins. It goes sort of out of control. And it's compulsive, yeah? You can't stop it. It's just racing round and round and round. And it's the effort of samya to find, and the thinking that comes from samya, to find a resolution of the problem, but without being sufficiently aware of what's going on, so it goes mad. And this is called prapancha. There's no adequate translation for this. Prapancha. It's said etymologically to be connected with the hand spreading out like that. Punch in Indian languages means five. So prapancha is, I don't know whether this is a false etymology or not, but it's rather a nice one. It spreads out. So from something that's sort of relatively simple, it becomes more and more complex. And you start, in extreme cases, if you're really very upset, it becomes really complex indeed. And so many different things get added together. In often a very compulsive way. I think rumination is a word that's often used in this context. I think it's a bit unfair to cows and sheep, but... rumination is sort of just compulsively dwelling upon in this unorganized, often actually quite sophisticated way that just dominates the mind and very, very difficult to stop it once you're in the middle of it, particularly in meditation. And probably most people have had some experience of it. Actually, you know, it's only in meditation that you get some glimpse of what's going on, but often... you can see other people. It's much easier, isn't it, than yourself. I was sitting on the tube the other day. I could see some people just sort of lost in uncontrollable thoughts. Maybe they weren't uncontrollable. That's what the appearance they gave was, of being sort of completely preoccupied, not really where they were. And you could see by the troubled look on their face, it wasn't a very pleasant experience. The Buddha speaks at one point about humanity as going about with whirling brain. So it's a whirling brain, a brain out of control. Not at all efficient. Of course, if you've got an educated brain, the whirling may be quite sophisticated. The thoughts may be quite complex. And they may draw in more and more elements from different areas. They may draw in attitudes from the culture around you. They may draw in your own past history, particularly, you know, if you've had a painful history, actually if you've had a pleasant one too. It may all get drawn into the compulsive process that takes over. What then happens in my experience, and I'm interested to know whether others experience this too, but there comes a point when it somehow or other resolves itself. I don't mean resolves in a constructive sense. It's as if all the threads come together in a sort of, aha, that's what's going on. So that, you know, somebody said something to you, you were hurt by it, so you start to conceptualize about that and then to reflect upon that, and then you start to interpret their behavior on the basis of this out-of-control thinking that's drawing on quite extraneous matters. So you might attribute to them motives that you've no way of knowing. That's the commonest way it happens. And you might even reconfigure what they said. Have you ever done this? You know, that you you come to think that somebody said something, and then when you go back and say to them, when you said that, I didn't actually say that. And, you know, they said something that had some of the same words, but you've gone away. And in the propuncha, you've rearranged them into the pattern of your interpretation that, oddly, doesn't resolve your pain. It causes you more pain, but it explains it. And to explain is, in some sense, to control. Or it feels like you're controlled. So my experience in this sort of situation is when you get to that point where you go, aha, she was motivated by that. There's a sort of perverse sense of pleasure. I've got her. I've caught it out. And because one of the functions of thinking is to control. Huh? That's what samnya is about. This is really important. Samnya is it's an from an evolutionary point of view. To take that point of view, you could also take a rebirth point of view. I don't think they contradict each other. But interpretation from an evolutionary point of view aids the organism in its struggle for survival, and the struggle for survival is inevitably competitive to some degree. Inevitably, your survival is at the expense of something else. And inevitably, you're competing. Again, this wonderful book, The Hidden Life of Trees, talks about the competition of trees for light and for nutrients and so forth. Also, interesting, it does talk about the cooperation that there is between trees and between trees and other species like certain kinds of fungus and even some animals and so on. But that's another side of it. But what you're essentially doing is trying to work out what's happening so that you've got then some control and that you can further your own interests. Yeah? That's what thinking is. It's a grasping in the first place. It can become more than that. We'll see this in a while. But in the first place, your thinking is an attempt to get control of the world. In a way, you could say even your senses are. When you simply look at things, the perceptions that come to you at the lowest level of samnya are appropriations. They're breaking the undifferentiated flow of things up into manageable units, manageable for your survival. So it's quite important from the point of view of understanding the processes in our mind that they're based upon a completely understandable and natural struggle to persist in your own being. Spinoza's term. Strive to persist in your own being. Every organism strives to persist in its own being, and it uses the faculties of the organism for that effort. So the propuncha is an attempt to, you know, go through all the data to come up with an explanation that makes us feel we've got some control. It may only be that it explains our suffering in terms of other people's actions, sometimes over which we have no control. But in some ways, when you can say, they did it because they are like that, you feel some sense of superiority and some restitution of your sense of self-dignity, even your selfhood. So propuncha, when it achieves a degree of resolution, to put it that way, that moment when it clunks into place, leads to what in, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to use another Sanskrit term, propuncha samnya, same word as here, sankar. So samnya obviously is, you can see that in the, forgive me a bit of etymology, but nya is from the same root as our word know, and from, you know, cognition, it's an Indo-European root, that gnya sound. And sun means together. It's the equivalent of con in Latin derived words, or sin in Greek derived words, synergy. So it means knowing together. So what it means is, in this context, taking certain elements of experience and assigning to them an identity, a knowable identity, if you see what I mean. Here, it means drawing all the elements of your experience into a total kind of apprehension, a total theory, probably. Theory isn't quite the right word, because it's theory feeling. It's not just a neutral sort of abstract mathematical theory. It's a theory that is strongly feeling laden. Sankar has very much that same meaning. Ka means something like to add. So adding up, adding together. So prapancha samya sankar is getting all those prapanchas, forming from them a total theory that is convincing and strongly, or, well, depends on the circumstance, quite strongly or felt. Huh? So it sort of, in a certain sense, resolves the situation. It resolves what's been sparked off back here. You've come to an interpretation that leaves you feeling, I know why I'm suffering, and I know what needs to change if I'm not to suffer in the future. Or I know where that pleasure came from, and I know how to get that pleasure again, to put it at the most crude. Because on that basis, you start to interpret the world. You've come to a judgment about the world, and then you fit what happens into that that judgment, what you could call perception bias. So that you built up a picture of the world which you carry round with you, like spectacles which are distorting, which you then see the world through. And the weird thing is, there's another word, isn't it? Confirmation bias, isn't there? That the interpretive framework that you've got is weirdly self-confirming. I'm going to Hungary on Thursday, where I'm working with some mitras from Roma communities. They actually like to be called gypsies, but it's complicated because of our political correctness here. But they live in a village which is probably two-thirds white Hungarian, and weird. There's absolutely no connection between the two communities, so they walk past each other. There's no contact, no hello or whatever. As a white person, I'm a Hungarian. So if I walk past another white person, they'll say, Jonapok, Kivanok, good morning, and so on. I'm known among the other communities, so they'll say it too. But what I've found in walking with my gypsy friends is that as the white people come towards us, obviously tension rises on both sides. It's minimal, not you know, most of the time it's not very strong, but it rises, and they start to play up. Do you know what I mean? They start to, as it were, thumb their noses. I mean, not literally. Because, you know, they can see themselves being put into a certain box, and they don't want to be there. So they're sort of almost confirming. So they, and it goes the other way too. You know, it's one that I'm familiar with, but of course I do it myself. I carry around certain patterns and pictures. When I see people, that pattern and picture is imposed upon the people I'm in contact with. And oddly, they sort of constrain somehow to confirm my perspective, you know, within reasonable limits. It's one of the big arts of life, is not to allow yourself to be boxed by others, and not even to not allow yourself to be boxed by deliberately not allowing yourself to be boxed, if you see what I mean, because that can be just as bad. But what then happens is that because you see the world through these spectacles, because you're seeing the world through this interpretive framework which has been built up, it can be extremely complex, disharmony and violence, taking up of the stick. And the example I gave is a good one, but there are so many others. It's just one it's not mine, if you see what I mean, so I'm better able to see it. I don't really belong with either, although my sympathies are with my friends, but I don't belong to that one, but I'm part of those as well. So the interpretive framework determines the interaction you have with the world around you, and determines that, to some extent, unless people are really aware, wide awake, and very skillful, determines their response to you. And so it goes. And, of course, it becomes, in geopolitical terms, it becomes really, really critical. In immediate social terms within any particular culture, it means that groups form which have attitudes to each other. I remember when I was a hippie many years ago, there were the Straits. Probably most of you lot, but the Straits. And you had a sort of a discord, you know, thing with Straits is you've got that sort of attitude. And so, of course, you're walking around with that attitude, which then, of course, the Straits, sure enough, behave in relation to. So that's a fairly mild one, but they get much worse than that. And it happens within our own immediate social relations. It happens within our community, our Buddhist community. It happens everywhere. Unless we're able to undo this process. So, I'm going to leave you all strung out with Prapancha Samya Sankha. Tomorrow I will resolve everything and you'll be completely free from it ever again. But you've probably already got some idea of what's implied. What I want to do is examine a bit more Samya Vitarka Vedana, thinking, because it's down here that the resolution comes. But before we do that, we need to examine a little bit more what happens in Samya. Something else comes in with Samya that makes this whole process go mad. And that the Buddha in the Sutta is trying to get us to understand. So I hope, laid out the basic problem. I think this is one of the most powerful applications of the principle of conditionality that we have, because it's so immediately recognisable in one's experience, and it's so beautifully and simply explains the things that go wrong between us. Because if you've got one set of people doing this, you've got another set of people doing it too, in an equal and opposite way, and result disharmony and even violence. Okay, that's it for today.